Okay, welcome back. Hope you had a good day today. And let's hold good thoughts for all of those people in New Orleans, the greater New Orleans area. Not a good time. And when you read stories about how President Bush apparently has... Well, let me read this little bit to you so in case you missed it, you can understand. Well, interesting. That site is now blocked. Anyway, the headline is Bush cuts the flood control budget by 44% to pay for defense contracts and so forth. So as we continue to watch the administration and the government eviscerate the home front, these kinds of things in the magnitude of which they have occurred can continue to be, unfortunately, in our future. We're cutting back everywhere where in reality we should be putting all that money at home here, rebuilding the infrastructure, taking care of our people, and all the rest of things that come with responsible government, but it's not happening. Joining us tonight is a young man who has written some remarkable articles, and you can find many of them at Rents.com. Just do a search under his name, Leland Lehrman, L-E-L-A-N-D-L-E-H-R-M-A-N. There are some really outstanding pieces at Rents.com and elsewhere on the Internet as well. He has impressed a lot of people, including John Kaminsky, whose recent article, Who's Wagging Whom, mentioned Leland Lehrman. He has, again, several others out there. Most recently, one I ran entitled ADL Zionist Policies Causing Rise in Anti-Jewish Sentiment by Leland Lehrman. Happy to run that. It raised a lot of very provocative and very important issues for all of us to think about. Leland, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Jeff.
My pleasure. Tell us about your background.
Well, I am of Russian Jewish extraction on my father's side, and on my mother's side, I am Celtic and Northern European.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my other background is as I was trained early on under my father, who's a well-known Republican politician and businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trained in the Republican point of view, and you know, as time has gone on,
trained or brainwashed.
Well, you know, it was a little bit of both, and and you know, my relationship with my father has gone back and forth, but right now it's very cordial. And the reason why I say this is because, like many of the things that we'll discuss tonight, people have there's a lot of room in people's lives to make major changes, and both myself and my father have made major changes with respect to a lot of our beliefs and our political beliefs. In particular, my family was, as most political families are, constantly involved in discussions about politics, and over time I began to stray from the Republican cause and ultimately becoming very liberal. Then only to find that the sort of liberal socialist ideology was also a favorite, apparently, of the industrialists, because in a state-run economy, they control absolutely everything. So I realized that there was this dichotomy happening. You had a sort of a right and left where the opposites were controlled, and they essentially kept swallowing the middle. And I recently saw a movie about the Spanish Civil War where that's exactly what happened. You had a Republican form of government.
Yeah.
Then you had Francisco Franco on one side, and on the other side you had the communists. And as a result of the war between the two sides, the entire thing sort of collapsed into chaos.
Right.
And over time I learned that this was actually a tried and true methodology, that this was the problem, reaction, solution, control, the opposition position that has actually been very well elucidated in those most controversial of protocols, which are the real reason for my having requested an interview with you tonight.
The Protocols of Zion. One of the most forbidden of all subjects.
I think it's the most forbidden.
Yeah, probably. We've never shied away from discussing that here over the years, and it has caused, as you would imagine, a lot of duress, shall we say, aimed at me and my program and what else I do. I'm one of those old-fashioned people, I think very much like you, who believes that everything should and could be discussed under the right circumstances. And if you do it honestly, openly, and with a true analytical mind, there's nothing wrong with it.
Well, just as the founders enshrined the First Amendment as, you know, including freedom of speech, I think that that shows just how fundamental it really is to a legitimate government and a decent society.
We either have it or we don't. We either have freedom of speech or we don't.
Yeah, I know.
It's not like being partially pregnant. It doesn't work. You either have it or you don't.
Yeah, and I can understand, you know, where people would, you know, object to certain opinions or disagree, but when just the very broaching of the topic becomes completely anathema, then you know to question what is really behind what is often a very hyperactive and hyper self-righteous point of view, whether
exactly.
It be regarding the Protocols of Zion or whether it be regarding Christian fundamentalism or regarding any very strongly held but not necessarily very friendly to all point of view, which is
right.
Generally what we find is that unfriendly points of view are frequently the ones that are most off-limits to discussion.
Well, and you mentioned the word anathema, but I go beyond that. They're actually becoming illegal against the law. Look at Ernst Zundel as an example.
Yeah,
you're just not allowed to talk about certain things
right.
In certain countries, or you're going to end up in prison.
Yeah, it's completely crazy. And now, of course,
beyond belief. It's totally crazy.
The state of Israel has now declared that it's going to extradite all of anybody around the world, if they can get a treaty with that country, and they'll do everything they can, I'm sure, who would dare to deny that less than 6 million Jews perished during World War II. And that, you know, that brings us back around to one of the reasons why I got involved in this topic. As a youth, for whatever reason, I was fascinated with World War II. I was fascinated partially because of the horrifying aspect of it, and I was always, you know, a big sort of fan of the Allies and demonized the Nazis along with everybody. And, of course, you know, the Nazis do represent one of the worst aspects of human nature. But, that whole point of view stayed with me for a long time, and it wasn't until I met a particularly intelligent and well-versed man here in Santa Fe, and we began discussing 9/11, that he began offering me a whole new window into history. And that window includes the unfortunate possibility that a sect, a small, we have to be very clear about this because this is where people get the most paranoid.
Right, you're defining it perfectly. Go right ahead.
It's a very small sect of, quite frankly, in my opinion, Lucifer worshippers who have somehow managed to infiltrate the Jewish religion through some of their doctrines, specifically those in the Zohar, which is the core of Kabbalism, and the Talmud. And it appears to have happened as a result of the very close proximity and the very close evolving ideological similarity between the high priests of Judaism and the high priests of Babylon. And as we know, my understanding is that fractionated banking actually originated in Babylon and or Sumeria and was subsequently distributed throughout the world by members of this particular sect of Judaism, along with, I believe, other folks like the Knights Templar, which
mm-hmm.
which brings me to a major point that I would like to say today. The Freemasonry, and the top level of Talmudic and Kabbalistic Judaism all join at the top, it appears, in this sort of New World Order ideology, and they share they share some of the same symbols. They share, for example, the six-pointed star, the Star of David, its original name is the Seal of Solomon. Solomon having been, from some points of view, an apostasy. He wasn't really entirely, this is not, you know, from my point of view, this is not problematic, but he wasn't entirely committed to Jewish monotheism. And some of these symbols, like the Star of David and the eye on the pyramid, mm-hmm. They have nothing to do with Judaism, and they really have nothing to do with anything other than a priest cult that is affiliated with monetary control.
And if I might interrupt,
please,
so we don't skip over any of these important points too quickly, he's talking about fractional banking, folks, and I think many of you know what fractional banking is. Now, Leland, we have a break here, but when we come back, let's talk a little bit just briefly about what fractional banking is. Now, you've been able to trace it back to your relative satisfaction all the way back to the beginning when this Luciferian supremacist sect began to assert itself and actually created fractional banking.
Several millennia B.C.
It's incredible. All right. Stand by. And fractional banking, of course, is what is the primary motor driving the enslavement of countless hundreds of millions of people.
That's correct.
All right. Stand by. We'll be right back with Leland Lehrman in just a minute. Okay, and we're back with Leland Lehrman talking about fractional banking, fractional reserve banking. This, you know, I've gone into banks, Leland, and asked even the managers. They don't know. They don't understand. They truly don't get it, most of them. Some do. They have an idea. So, well, that's okay. That's the way it's done. Bottom line, well, tell us, give us your view, and we'll talk about it a little bit. How does fractional reserve banking work? What are the laws which allow American banks and savings institutions to just so unbelievably gouge the public?
Well, it's a very simple procedure that's been disguised behind a variety of mental and doctrinal errors. The very simple procedure is that banks are legally allowed to lend money that they don't have and collect interest on it.
Don't have and never will have. Folks.
And all they really do is get authorization from the Federal Reserve or from the, you know, essentially from the main authority of the land, which is now kind of nebulously spread between the Federal Reserve, Congress, and the
sure
executive
is.
Branch and the judicial. So the Federal Reserve has now actually become, and you know, it was warned, people were warned of this by people like Louis McFadden.
Who was apparently killed for his efforts.
Yeah, he was, they attempted a poisoning and then they attempted an assassination with a gun and then finally I believe they succeeded. But yeah, there were many people who warned us that ultimately in the event that a private cartel were able to control the nation's money supply, we would lose our representative democracy, our republican form of government, and of course they were right, at least to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And the central lie is that it is necessary to distribute currency at interest. The bottom line is that there's no problem, there's no reason why the government couldn't just distribute currency to the citizenry adequate to the needs of that citizenry for the purposes of trade and survival.
Without usury.
Without usury, because now, you know, when I discussed this with my father, who's a very well-known economist, he said that the interest on the debt is what it costs the Federal Reserve to actually create a financial system.
Mm-hmm.
But that's ridiculous, because there's no way that it could be a cost $1 trillion to have a functioning currency in America. I mean, I don't even know what the national debt is these days. I think it's more than $1 trillion. But
I think it's six.
Yeah, okay. See, I've seen figures like that. So six or so. Can you imagine that, you know, this is the price that we have to pay just to have a currency?
Yeah, now let me get back to one thing. Look, to keep it real simple, folks, your neighborhood-friendly bank, whether it's an individual hometown bank or part of a chain, uses fractional banking to make loans. And the laws, as I understand them currently, are formatted dictate that the bank has to only have $1 on deposit for every $10 it can loan out.
Between 10 and 20.
That's right. Minimum 10. It's loaning out money that doesn't exist. It'll never exist. It's all paper. They have $1 on account. Let's take the maximum. They can loan out 20 bucks for every $1 they take in. You get the picture here?
It's like a legalized scam.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Yeah, and again, most people do not have a clue. Not a clue.
Yeah.
So they take in a $1,000 deposit. Gee, they can loan out 10 grand to Mr. and Mrs. John Doe for 8 or 9%, whatever. And that's how they make their money. And then they, every time John Doe puts money in, they just go ahead and extrapolate from that.
Yeah, and then of course what they do is they compound the interest too.
Yep.
And then through the system of credit cards, they have actually legitimated much, much higher interest rates,
right,
up to 19.
18, 19, sure.
Yeah, so that is how they have generated this gigantic sucking machine, which is effectively an incredibly huge and malignant parasite.
Imprisoning the lives of countless people and their children.
That's right. And they've used the same strategy in third world countries. And as John Perkins revealed in his incredible book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, those who don't agree to accept the loans,
mm-hmm,
are replaced,
yep,
or their countries are invaded in the event that the entire country,
yep,
seeks to refuse.
And guess what they have to, ladies and gentlemen, use as collateral to get these forced loans?
Natural
the loans are
resources.
Forced upon. They have to put up their own natural resources as collateral. You get it? Then they default on the loan. And guess, see, the big, I know some Brazilians, and the big joke in Brazil is not owned by Brazilians. Hasn't been for years. But that's another story. Go ahead, please.
Well, the same can be said for America, because through the process of tightening and loosening the money supply, which is what is called the business cycle, they extend credit and then rapidly pull it back in. And during the process of pulling back the credit, you have what's known as a depression. And during a depression, those who are on the inside have gotten out early, and those whose businesses collapse and lose their homes all end up sacrificing those homes to the banks, who pick them up at huge fractions of their real value.
And they start all over again.
Yeah, and ultimately, this same organization begins to assert a greater and greater control of the United States of America's military, industrial, and real estate markets.
Okay.
So now this particular scam, and the gentleman that I referred to earlier was instrumental in bringing this to my attention, it has kind of a life of its own.
All right, let's do that just a minute, Leland. We have a break here. So stay tuned. This is a very important conversation. I hope all of you are listening keenly. And if you're not able to hear it now in full, you'll be able to hear it in the archives. Leland Lehrman is my guest. That's L-E-H-R-M-A-N. If you want to do that search on my website, you'll come up with a number of articles he's written. Brilliant young man. I think he's going to be around for a long time, leading a lot of people into the light with the truth. He's an extraordinary journalist. Be right back. Okay, welcome back. A conversation with Leland Lehrman tonight. All right, let's hear that story about the man who has had such influence in your life recently. I'd like to follow this very closely.
Okay, well, as a result of getting in trouble with the Anti-Defamation League for drawing a parallel between Jewish supremacists of the era of the Protocol of Zion, which is approximately the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century,
okay,
and the current crop of Jewish supremacists represented in America by the neoconservatives and their right-wing Israeli allies, who are responsible for bringing us into war with Iraq and now plotting a new war with Iran.
And these by the way, these same Zionist supremacists have, of course, co-opted the State of Israel. Well, it never had a chance. It was a Zionist plan from the very beginning. All you got to do is read World War II history and understand that the Zionists in Switzerland turned down the rabbis from Germany when they brought a request to them for $2 million to gain safe passage for all Jews out of occupied Europe. It's all written. Jewish scholar Lenny Brenner, Dr. Henry Mako, and others have cited the documents, the quotes. It's all there. So there's your supremacist at its worst. Go ahead.
Yeah, the statements were made that it was necessary for the Jewish people to make major sacrifices in
right.
order to legitimate their land grab in Palestine.
Right.
And this was very open. You see, religion has this sacrificial aspect to it through all history.
Isn't that bizarre when you think about it?
Some people actually believe that by sacrificing to a god, you gain favor with that god.
What an ass backward, completely screwed up, corrupted view of life and morality. Jeez.
I couldn't agree more, but for whatever reason, I think that the central problem is the famous a deal that was offered to Jesus and appears to have been offered to many people, which is that Satan offers worldly control if one but serve him. Now, the reason how come that worldly control unfortunately does have some traction is that through serving Satan, you are legitimized to use violence. And, in fact, you are required to use violence.
Yep.
And as a result, peace-loving peoples rarely stand a chance when it comes to dealing with a warrior or sort of satanic culture which believes firmly that through the destruction of other people, they are gaining legitimate access. Now, the people at the top realize that this is actually a deal with the devil. But what they do is they propagandize it as if it were a deal with God.
Yeah.
And this is the central fallacy of most of the world's religions, that somehow God will give you the right to murder, steal from, and criminalize other people because you are somehow either chosen as a race, chosen as a religion, or authorized to buy your subscription to a specific doctrine.
Right.
So the reason why I'm discussing the scam of fractionated reserve banking in the context of Lucifer worship, or worship of, basically submission to a deity which demands human sacrifice, is that this is really not about Judaism. It's not actually about races. It's not even really about religions, unless, of course, you can call Satanism or Lucifer worship a religion. And in my research, which has essentially just begun, I've found that there is kind of like a rat line, which is the famous word used for the distribution of Nazis around the world after the Second World War. But there's kind of like a rat line that extends into a variety of the world's religions, that where kind of Lucifer's hand is kind of reaching down and looking for likely converts or likely assets, and into Judaism, it infiltrates through the Kabbalah and through the Talmud and through the particularly Deuteronomy, Isaiah 60 and 61, and some of the other scriptures in the so-called Jewish canon, which legitimate racist and murderous and warlike behavior. But the same exact thing happens through the ranks of Freemasonry, which also extends into the Christian religion. Freemasonry, up until about the 33rd or the 32nd degree, maintains that it considers Christ to be a very important prophet at a minimum. But once you get, higher than that, the assertion is boldly made, as in Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma, that Lucifer is the one that you are worshiping. And so this is not about Judaism. It's about It's about a specific set of ideas which are legitimating human sacrifice, legitimating theft, and legitimating domination, which have unfortunately corrupted most of the world's religions through this infamous devil's bargain that if you will serve me, I will give you worldly domination.
Mm-hmm.
And so, unfortunately, my people on my father's side have been terribly, terribly affected by this evil scam. And they have somehow allowed themselves to be sucked into it. Not all of them, of course. But some of them, for some reason, are still supporting the very same people who willingly sacrificed them during World War II in order to achieve their State of Israel. And the record of the State of Israel demonstrates that the leadership of the State of Israel is willing to perpetrate the exact same thing on the Palestinian people, as if the Holocaust never ever happened, as if the lesson of the Holocaust is only for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as I finally began looking at this, I said to myself, "Oh my God!" Like you mentioned with the Lenny Brenner quote, the reality is that high-level Jewish Illuminists or Lucifer worshippers have most certainly collaborated with the Lucifer worshippers and all the other sects, like Nazism, like high-level Freemasonry. They have most certainly collaborated in the development of this New World Order plan.
Right.
And the reason why the Protocols of Zion is important is because it is a terrifically well-elucidated encapsulation of all of the methods and techniques that are going that have been used to bring about the New World
and
Order.
And are being used. And, of course, the big argument is waged by those who would try to deflect the reality of what you just stated, that these are, in fact, the techniques being used, is that, they were forged. They're forgeries. They're a hoax. Well, you know, it kind of doesn't matter who wrote them, because this is the blueprint of how the New World Order is implementing its death grip over the rest of us. That's the lesson of the protocols. It's crucial.
It's evidence in a criminal case.
Oh, you bet. Stand by. Be right back in just a minute with Leland Lehrman. Okay, back with you and with Leland Lehrman. Okay, Leland, let's proceed. Very important. Again, the Protocols of Zion, often mired in the argument about hoaxed, they're hoaxed, or they're forgeries. The Tsar's secret police wrote them. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They need to be examined for what they are. And what they are is a geopolitical, social blueprint of world domination, which is being essentially carried out right before our very eyes. So take it for what it's worth, folks. It's an incredible document.
That's right. The Protocols of Zion, which is available just about all over the Internet, so there's, I don't know, there must be 5 or 10 or more websites that have it in its complete details. But if you look at the text of the article that I submitted to Rents.com entitled ADL Zionist Policy Causing Rise in Anti-Jewish Sentiment, you'll see three of the most important articles that actually go into reasons for believing the authenticity of the document. Now, as Jeff said, there is, in fact, no reason why one cannot read these this literature if it happens that it's a forgery. You know, And the reason why it's stated to be a forgery is because there may be some interpolations in it. You know, there may be some places where translators have mistranslated it. I mean,
taken liberties, which is what, you know, talk about translating. How many times they rewritten the Bible? For
exactly, and that's the point I'm exactly trying to make, which is we know that the Bible, most historical documents that have been translated and retranslated, and apparently the originals were French. They were then translated into Russian. From Russian, they were translated back into English. So, you know, all of this will lead, of course, to some speculation regarding the authenticity of each phrase. But if you look at it as a whole, you can see that the very, very unfortunate reality of the Protocols of Zion, and this requires a little bit of context regarding Jewish supremacism over time, but Ivan Fraser, Paquita de Shishmaref, and many other writers have shown that the very unfortunate thing about this is that it does, the Protocols of Zion do fit into a Jewish supremacist wing within the very much maligned and then, of course, totally destroyed religion of Judaism. And it is to the Jewish people that I appeal to look at this and recognize that we must seriously question whether or not our leaders have, in fact, been instrumental in our own destruction. And we must now completely separate ourselves from any leadership which legitimates falsity of doctrine or warlike doctrine for the essence of the Jewish religion, as I understand it, which is the Old Testament. I mean, the Ten Commandments. Of all of the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments stand out as a shining example of a very short law, which was, of course, then even shortened further by Jesus to the Golden Rule, which one can live by, live honorably by, and assume that a society that based itself upon those premises would be peaceful, productive, and happy. But this is a bit of a detour. Let's go back and take a look at why the Protocols of Zion actually represent an unfortunately contextually accurate picture of Jewish supremacism. The Talmud, an extremely gigantic body of work, which is known to be the heart and soul of the so-called Jewish religion, and in particular the Eastern European Jewish groups, is split into two variants. One is the Babylonian and the other is the Jerusalem Talmud. But these are gigantic bodies of work. In these bodies of work, the Talmud and its affiliated mystical aspect, which is known as the Zohar, and which is the focus in the center of Kabbalism, we find again and again the repetition of the idea that the Jewish people is superior. Unfortunately, it is often stated that it is okay to steal from anybody who isn't Jewish. Gentile or Goyim are the typical words that are used in the Talmud. And this is the official Sansino translation of the Talmud, so this is not a transliteration problem. We can see direct evidence within the Talmud of racist doctrines being promulgated.
They are, and the word racist is absolutely appropriate. And then, of course, they have everything backed up with the Kol Nidre.
Well, that's right. And the Kol Nidre, as Henry Ford brought to a limited population's attention, unfortunately, does appear to legitimate the making of contracts with prior knowledge that one will not honor those contracts. Henry Ford's quote on that effect was that as a result of the Kol Nidre, anybody who believes that they can trust in the business integrity of somebody who espouses this philosophy of, you know, it's okay if I make this contract because, well,
I'll
you know,
be forgiven in advance. I don't have to worry about it.
Exactly. You know, so. And then the other argument about the Protocols of Zion, the other two arguments, one that you mentioned already, and that it was a forgery, and the other argument that is often used to legitimate to legitimate the idea that nobody should ever read it or discuss it or believe in it or have anything to do with it, is that it was one of the documents that Hitler cited as the basis of his anti-Semitic beliefs. Now, this is a very complicated subject right here. The reality is very simple. It doesn't matter what somebody used one document or another in order to legitimate. That has no bearing on whether or not the document is authentic. That would be like saying that because the Crusades were mounted as a result of Christianity, or as, of course, the interpretation of Christianity promulgated by the political entities of the time, that therefore the Bible is a forgery, which is, of course, ridiculous. But for some reason, the Anti-Defamation League and the people that are harassing me here in New Mexico believe that as a result of the fact that Hitler used the Protocols of Zion, therefore they are off limits. You cannot discuss them. You cannot even... And unfortunately, the Anti-Defamation League also believes, and has shown this, I believe, in some of the laws, the hate speech laws, which it has developed in Canada and other nations around the world, it does not believe, which is also actually in the Military Code of Justice, that truth is a legitimate defense. In other words, it doesn't matter whether or not the protocols are true or not. From their perspective, if they engender what they call anti-Semitism, it is not a topic for polite discussion. Anyway, I respectfully disagree with that point of view, of course, and I think that as a result of the fact that the Protocols of Zion represent and demonstrate that there may in fact be a small group within the body of the Jewish people who believes in this type of a murderous and racist doctrine, that it is essential for us as a Jewish people to self-examine and look and see whether or not it is in fact a sort of parasitic leadership which has brought upon us the problems that we rightfully as well blame on other agencies like Adolf Hitler. And this brings up what is just completely anathema to the Anti-Defamation League, and which is the quote that they use for my radio show that they're most upset about is the fact that I said that it is important for the Jewish people to re-examine the innocence of the Jewish people as a whole with respect to the Holocaust. And, of course, the vast majority of Jewish people have nothing to do with any of this. They're, you know, simply living their lives like the rest of us. But to the extent that any Jewish person places their faith, their conscious, willing faith in a racist or murderous doctrine and willingly does this, then they do begin to assume some responsibility.
And that goes for any religion.
Of course, and you know, it's the other thing that they keep saying to me is, well, why do you keep bringing up about the Jewish people? Why don't you talk about the fact that, you know, Islamic fundamentalists have problems and Christian fundamentalists have problems?
Yeah, well, and they sure as hell do.
Well, yeah, there's two reasons. One is that's already been done.
It's been done all over the newspaper.
Yeah,
the media, as it is,
exactly.
For years, for decades.
That's right. So my point is that in the event that you have what is clearly a supremacist, Jewish supremacist cabal operating within the State Department, within the Defense Department, within the right-wing establishment in the United States of America, within the right-wing establishment of Israel, represented by people like Doug Feith, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz.
Oh, and let me suggest, your litany of names is absolutely essential, but I've had Jews on this program for years who wholeheartedly agree with the gist of what you're saying. They are outraged at how they've been manipulated by these Zionist supremacists, and it's getting to be where there is about to be a civil war over there, over this. This is a main part of it. They're tired of being led down the road once again.
Well, yeah, and the idea that somehow Israel is going to come out of a greater war in the Middle East, which would certainly come about in the event of war with Iran, it's totally crazy. Israel is just as likely to become the number one target of most of the Middle Eastern regimes in the event of such a war,
right,
as anybody else is. In fact, they're much more likely.
We don't want war for anybody.
Exactly.
Jews, Muslims, Arab, Christians. We've got to stop this, folks. And what we are is citizens of the planet. We've got to get out of these clubs, you know, and stop thinking that we're, because I'm in this club, I'm superior to those in that club. It doesn't work that way. We're all supposedly equal, at least we start out that way. But what happens along the bumpy road in life can be pretty shocking. Okay, we'll be back hearing more of Leonard Lerman's views, and our conversation will continue after the top of the hour news break. Does Leland Lerman have the right to talk about these things on the radio? Does he have the right to talk about, can he mention the name of the book, The Protocols of Zion? Or does that make him a self-hating Jew?
Well, that's exactly what they told me. The woman from the Anti-Defamation League, we started a conversation over the internet. Finally, I explained to her why I believed that Jewish people had to reevaluate whether or not the Anti-Defamation League, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and all of the other effectively Jewish supremacist and ideologically superior acting people could, whether or not we could support them anymore or be affiliated with them anymore. We can't really believe them anymore because, quite frankly, they don't know what they're talking about. They polemicize regarding the Protocols of Zion without actually really knowing what they are at all.
You know, I'll tell you the truth, and I haven't done this too often, but people have written to me, how dare you talk about this? And I asked them, and those who will talk, have you read them? Did you actually sit down and read? No. I don't need to read them.
I know, exactly. Right, right, I know. So anyway, once she realized that I actually believed that there was a chance that the Protocols of Zion were authentic, and I explained a few other things. In particular, I mentioned Benjamin Friedman's speech, which is posted also on your website.
He was an amazing man, just in a word, Jewish American, who decided to, he didn't blow the whistle, he blew the horn. On the whole scam.
And, yeah, he had a couple $1 million with which to do it. He was a very successful businessman, worked directly with Henry Morgenthau at the Secretary of Treasury under Woodrow Wilson.
Extraordinary man.
And he explained why it was that the German people harbored such a resentment against the Jewish people. And the reason was that in 1917, when the Allies, the British, obtained the Balfour Declaration, which was the declaration by Lord Balfour, who was closely affiliated with the leadership of England at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Lord Balfour submitted to Lord Rothschild, and that name is very significant in this whole story, a document stating that, in theory, in a limited sense, the British Crown agreed that Palestine would be provided as a potential homeland for Jewish people.
Correct.
It also specifically stated that all the Palestinians' rights, civil rights, and political rights would be respected. But the Balfour Declaration, nonetheless, was a very, very valuable document to the international Zionist community. And as a result of obtaining this document from the Allies, they decided to throw their entire weight behind the Allies. Of course, at the time, the Ottoman Empire, which was a Turkish Islamic caliphate, I believe one might describe it, was never going to give Palestine back to the Jews. So it required the Allies to provide this promise. And now, up till that time, the German nation had been one of the most friendly nations of all time to the Jewish people, providing them with political, social, and economic liberty on par, I believe, with all German citizens. However, when at the Treaty of Versailles it became obvious to the German leadership that the entirety of the German Jewish supremacist groups, which include the major banker families like the Warburgs, probably also, I'm not certain of this, I know the Warburgs were involved, but the large industrial conglomerates led by, I believe his name was Walter Rathenau. Anyway, you should really check out that Benjamin Friedman piece because it spells it out in detail. What happened was the entire German Jewish or German Zionist community completely sucked the support out from behind their legitimate German state. In other words, they had decided to completely undercut the country in which they lived. And as a result, the anger, the resentment about this was extreme because Versailles produced some of the most awful suffering in Germany of all time. The Depression in America was probably quite civilized compared to the destruction that was wrought upon the German nation at the end of World War One. So now, of course, this was horribly capitalized upon by Hitler, whose anti-Semitic beliefs were racial and religious in nature, and very broad, apparently. And for some reason, which hasn't quite been explained to my satisfaction yet, Hitler's anti-Semitism was entirely blind. And I'm very suspicious about this, because the reality is that it was really effectively only the leadership who perpetrated the crime, or the treasonous crime of selling out the German nation to the Allies in World War One. And so as a result, I can't quite figure out why Hitler decided that the entire Jewish race deserved to pay for what was clearly the instrument of only a very small group of people. And I'll tell you what makes me really concerned, and it's a few lines from Protocol Number 9, entitled Re-Education. And this is what it states. Nowadays, which is around 1897 to 1900 when it was written. Nowadays, if any states raise a protest against us, that is the international Jewish supremacists, it is only pro forma at our discretion and by our direction, for their anti-Semitism is indispensable to us for the management of our lesser brethren. When I first read that quote, I felt a vague kind of onrushing sense of extreme horror. The possibility that the anti-Semitism of Nazi Germany was actually manipulated ultimately by this same Luciferian supremacist cabal that has preyed upon the Jewish faith for all of these years, that they would actually create this type of anti-Semitism not only to perpetrate the state of Israel, but potentially also to, in perpetuity, create a myth of Jewish victimhood behind which they could forever hide their actions, which ultimately are domineering, murderous, and warlike. And as, you know, now that I've revealed one of the most horrifying conclusions one might come to as a result of looking at the Protocols of Zion, let me step back just a moment and tell you why I believe that their authenticity is very likely. As I indicated in my article on Rents entitled ADL Zionists Engender and Anti-Semitism.
It's still up there in the featured stories, by the way.
Yes, you will find links to not only the protocols themselves, but a whole bunch. In fact, well, just three, really, but three very important authentications of the Protocols of Zion. And they deal with two particular things. The most important of all of them, probably, is the link to a Russian website which contains the full text of Waters Flowing Eastward. Waters Flowing Eastward was written by a woman by the name of Pakita Deshishmarev, writing under a pen name, L. Fry. And Pakita Deshishmarev made the incredible case for the authenticity of the Protocols of Zion in this very extensive book, specifically citing some of the German and French documents to which she had access because of her vast command of language. Furthermore, she was married to a Russian military man who died during the revolution. And as a result, she was very well suited both emotionally and linguistically to examine all of the evidence that came to her through the original distributor of the Protocols of Zion in Russia, that is, a man by the name of Sergei Nilus. So, lest we paint a picture that suggests that the Tsar's secret police actually was capable of forging such a document, let's look at some of the cases that are made in Waters Flowing Eastward. In particular, the case that most of the Jewish international Jewish supremacist community makes is that they were proved to be forgeries in a Swiss court case.
Right.
But as, in fact, that's not the case.
It didn't happen. I read that too, yeah.
It did not happen. There was an initial court case wherein it was determined by the High Court that the judge was heavily indebted to a group of Jewish people who were also apparently sponsoring the lawsuit at the same time. Well, now that's an obvious conflict of interest. So the High Court looked at this and they said, first of all, there's no way that we can determine whether or not the protocols were authentic or not. But there is definitely evidence of manipulation by the plaintiffs, which would be the Jewish supremacists, in their contention that they were false.
Now remember, we're talking about Jewish supremacists, Catholic supremacists, Muslim, Arab supremacists. It doesn't matter. This is an affliction of the human condition. Leland is just talking about tonight the issues of the protocols and Jewish. He's Jewish. He's got a right to say these things, although I don't think you have, Leland, too many friends who are ready to take the heat for you at this point.
I've found that to be the case.
Lonely territory. Stand by. We'll come right back. Okay, back with Leland Lehrman, and a very controversial subject. I hope you're enjoying it, agree or disagree. It's great to air these things out as best we can. Go ahead, Leland.
Well, regarding the authenticity of the Protocols of Zion, there are the allegation that the Bern trials, the Switzerland trials, proved them to be a forgery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you look in Waters Flowing Eastward, and the full text of Waters Flowing Eastward is linked in that article on your website, you'll see an Appendix 2, which goes into great detail on what the Switzerland trials actually stated, and what they actually stated was that it was not the role of the court to determine the authenticity or non-authenticity of the Protocols of Zion. So the other argument against the authenticity of the protocols was that they were plagiarized from the works of Montesquieu, the works of Maurice Joly, in particular his dialogues between Montesquieu and Machiavelli. Now, the places wherein these allegations are made typically cite a couple of passages as proof that the entire thing is plagiarized. Now, I don't know about you, but I generally consider plagiarism to be when significant percentages of a document are plagiarized from one to another. But the argument for plagiarism is basically made based on just a few passages which bear similarities. And the other extremely curious thing is that Maurice Joly was, in fact, either a Mason or closely affiliated with Masons.
Hmm.
And through the history of Illuminati and sort of Kabbalistic superiority lodges, like the B'nai B'rith of Israel, Skull and Bones of the Anglo-American establishment, the Bavarian Illuminati, many of these world domination techniques have been sort of handed back and forth, capitalized upon. For example, it's well known that many of the tenets of the Illuminati became the foundations of the Communist Manifesto. So the fact that he was either a Mason or affiliated with the Masons means that he would have been exposed to many of these doctrines through his affiliation to Masonic lodges, wherein, you know, these types of world domination ideologies, these ideologies were circulating within this milieu. So quite frankly, it doesn't actually discredit the fact that it doesn't actually prove that they were forgeries at all, but it does go to show that there is, in fact, a very close correlation and a very close and tight relationship between Freemasonic lodges, Illuminized Freemasonic lodges, and Kabbalistic and Jewish supremacy. I believe, I can't remember if it's Waters Flowing Eastward or Ivan Fraser's document or the other document they're cited discussing the authenticity. There is some assertion that the Protocols of Zion are more likely to be some people suggest that they would be Jesuit, other people suggest that they would be Freemasonic. But when you look at the overall structure of Freemasonry, you find that there is, in fact, a very, very strong Jewish influence or supremacist influence. In fact, if you look at the Great Seal of the United States of America, you'll see the Star of David right above the eagle. Also, one of the important points that the people who are trying to discredit the Protocols of Zion's authenticity make is that it bears a strong relationship to certain other political doctrines of the time. But, these things have been, there have been a whole lot of political domination doctrines throughout time. So just because one or two little pieces of the doctrine appear to bear similarity with another one doesn't mean that the entire document is plagiarism.
Well, well stated. I don't know how else you can add to that effectively. Okay, Benjamin Friedman. There have been others. There are more Jews now coming forward and talking, although it's not easy. The pressure from organized groups like the ADL is vicious. It's nonstop. They have a lot of power. They don't represent most of the Jewish people I know, and yet they act like they do. And it's most unfortunate.
Yeah, I never really thought I was going to get involved in this. What happened was I decided to get a radio show after the 2004 election. And as a result of what appeared to have been another stolen election, the 2000 being the first, not that I particularly preferred John Kerry. In fact, I didn't vote for him. And
he was a fraud.
Yeah, and Al Gore, similarly distasteful. But the idea that the electoral system had been completely destroyed by people like Catherine Harris in Florida and Ken Blackwell and blatantly partisan manipulative...
Oh, the whole thing was beyond belief. Look, it's the most disgraceful epoch in American political history.
I would agree. So I thought, well, if I actually believe that the citizens have a duty to their country to assist them, I should get on the radio. And so during that time frame, it became obvious that this neoconservative cabal was attempting to take us into another war with Iran. And as a result of what I consider to be a very dangerous idea, I thought that I needed to begin to address this topic because I think that there is a historical relevance.
There certainly is, and we should learn from history, but unfortunately our rearview mirror has been knocked off of our social vehicle in this country. We have another half an hour to go with Leland Lerman. Stay tuned, and we will continue after this. Hi, back with Leland Lerman. So, Leland, what are Jews to do? Jews who aren't supremacists, who are just Americans, like the rest of us? The same question can be posed to members of any other club or religion, whatever you want to call them. What are they to do with the organizations that have B'nai B'rith, the ADL, which literally attack... I don't know how many assaults you've had to endure of one kind or another, but it hasn't been pleasant for you, I'm sure. What are they going to do? It's not easy to be called self-hating and to be vilified in the media, have pressure put on you in hundreds of different ways, and they do that.
Well, certainly it takes a little bit of courage for the few of us at this point, but we can take heart knowing that many people... throughout history have endeavored to cast light upon the unfortunate arrangements of priests and bankers and their subversion of different religious ideologies. The religious ideology is sort of like the mind control component. The banks, of course, are the physical control component, and then by asserting their physical control component, the banks, then they can obviously buy militaries, which militaries are virtually always for sale. Unfortunately, that's the way it appears through history. I think that the idea is the typical resistance idea, which is to make sure that as many people as you know are aware of the work that you're doing and the positions that you are espousing. Make sure that what I am doing now is every sponsor that is contacted by the ADL, any one of my radio show sponsors that is contacted by the ADL and threatened with termination of business by the Jewish community, that's basically the way they're saying it. I, of course, call them up and I explain to them that unfortunately it's this type of sort of supremacist and we're better than everybody else and if we say something is right then you'd better believe us or you know we're going to make sure that the money is sucked out of your business you know that this is all very dangerous, that this is not the way dialogues happen in decent society. And furthermore, I've explained to my sponsors that it is very unfortunate, but the Jewish people who have aligned themselves with their leaders, who have perpetrated some very criminal policies and very racist policies through the years, must learn as maturing people to accept some degree of responsibility for the harassment that they have suffered. And as a person of Russian Jewish extraction, who has throughout his life always been told that the pogroms in Russia were completely blind and that we were unfairly targeted. I know all of the sort of feelings of the Jewish community that are on the line here, but I think that as an older brother is asked to be mature in the context of an argument with a younger brother,
right.
I think it is time that the that the very old group of Jewish people, that the very old religion, the very old, I mean, all
the old guard.
Are old. Yeah. We're all old, right?
Right.
So it's time for us to mature, and we need to learn to take responsibility and say, yes, it takes two to tango. Sure, the Nazis were terrible, but look at the fact that Warburg, our supposed leader in Germany, was making sure that he came to power. What does this mean?
Right.
We need to start looking at this and distributing this via word of mouth.
Let's not forget about the Bolsheviks either.
Well, you know, of course. I mean, the very sad reality of the Bolshevik Revolution was that it was largely the culmination of a plan that had been in the works for a long time to subject Russia to the whims of the New World Order. Apparently, Lionel Rothschild had attempted a New World Order at the Congress of Vienna, and the only major European nation which had refused to join it was Russia. And as a result, the satanic Jewish supremacist group, a very small group around Rothschild, decided that they were ultimately going to have to destroy the Christian autocratic regime in Russia. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying the czars were some pillars of virtue, but certainly the continuing interpretation, even in today's grade schools and colleges, was that somehow the Russian Revolution was just like the French Revolution. The propaganda is that these were groundswells of support based on a general disenchantment and anger against the ruling classes. Well, Alexander II, who was assassinated, I believe, had already begun. He had liberated the serfs. He was beginning to develop a parliamentary democracy system to coincide with his rulership, etc. You know, there were movements in very progressive directions, but nevertheless, through history, we are taught that somehow the Bolshevik Revolution was a liberating force for Russia.
Oh, please.
When, of course, it eventually turned out to be nothing of the sort. But back in 1920, the Jewish community worldwide was celebrating the Bolshevik Revolution,
yeah,
and openly taking credit for it. If you look at the edition of the American, one of the editions of the American Hebrew, I believe it's in 1920,
mm-hmm,
it basically straight out says that the Bolshevik Revolution was a product of Jewish dissatisfaction and Jewish planning. And it also said that the same thing was going to happen all over the world. So if you can see that when they feel like they've had a great success, this small group of Jewish supremacists, every once in a while, gets crazy enough to actually brag about it. But just before I get too distracted from this, what I really wanted to bring up this point was that in the context of what do we do, well, very big-time Jewish people have decided to spill the beans on this over time, and it doesn't actually take that much work to find their writings. It'll just take maybe a couple of weeks, but I guess we'll come back to this after the break. But Jacob Bronfman in the 1860s converted from Judaism to Christianity, and he revealed some of the workings of the supremacist Kahal, which was what it was called in Russia. And as a result, there ended up the great war between the Christian autocracy, the czars, and the Jewish supremacists. And that is actually the story of the pogroms much more than anything else.
Okay. All right. Controversy with Leland Lehman. Lerman. Yeah, I know somebody named Leonard Lehman. That's the problem. That's a true story. Leland Lerman is my guest, and we'll be right back. All right, back with Leland Lehrman, our final segment tonight. And we're going to wrap up a story that will become only more and more controversial, of course, as time passes. But we've gotten a very good overview of it from Leland's perspective tonight. And go ahead, Leland. Let's see how we wrap this up.
Well, as I mentioned before, I'd always been taught that the Russian pogroms were anti-Semitic in nature and were blind and were unfair. And then in the context of Waters Flowing Eastward, again, a very important book, and if you type in Waters Flowing Eastward into Google, you'll probably come up with a link to the full text of it. It's also linked from the Wrench.com article that I wrote recently.
Right.
You will find in Chapter 5, page 189, a description of Jacob Bronfman and his work. And Jacob Bronfman, at the age of 34, gave up his rabbinical, I guess he was a rabbi. He gave up being a rabbi at the age of 34 and converted to Christianity. And over the next several years, he decided to explain what it was that was really the driving force behind Jewish society, the Jewish society of the time. And now one has to understand that what he was really talking about was the driving force behind the rabbinical ideology, because in Jewish supremacist and sort of deeply rabbinical Jewish ideology, if you're not a priest, if you're not a rabbi, you are a lower caste. And the rabbis refer to those who are not learned as Am Haaretz, which is Hebrew for people of the soil. And people of the soil, or Am Haaretz, within the Hebrew caste, the Jewish caste system, these people cannot even testify in court, at least certainly not on the same level as the rabbis themselves. So it was on behalf, obviously, of both the Jewish people and the Christian people that Jacob Bronfman attempted to explain what was going on within the rabbinical structure. And he wrote two books. One was called The Book of the Kahal, and the Kahal is similar to the word cabal. It's a sort of a unit of organization at a very high level designed to further a certain specific aim. And in this particular instance, it was also the name of the governing structure of the Jewish priestly class. And he explained the operations of the Kahal and the Jewish Brotherhoods, which are a loosely affiliated group of secret societies affiliated with the Kahal. And this material was, of course, extremely of great concern to the Christian Church in Russia and the Tsar and his people. And as a result of the exposé of the operations of the Kahal, and let me, you know, without going into too much detail, because it's done very well in the book Waters Flowing Eastward, let me just say that it involves organized economic predatory activity, legitimated by Talmudic injunctions allowing theft and other types of deceptive practices in business and in general social interactions between Jewish people and non-Jewish people who are referred to as goyim or Gentiles, the word goyim often being used, of course entirely being used in a disparaging way to refer to them as cattle.
Still is, always
or,
is.
Or animals. Yeah, and
sure.
Apparently some people are still raised to view all goy or all non-Jewish people as subhuman, and of course these words like subhuman are used in the Talmud. Anyway, this was the disconcerting material that Jacob Bronfman probably converted as a result of, and then brought to the attention of the Tsar and the Orthodox Church in Russia. And as a result, it states here that in 1867, the official Jewish Kahal was suppressed by a circular of the Tsar. And And they were, Alexander II apparently was the czar who circulated the this oppression document and issued the edict that, you know, we must no longer allow the Jewish Kahal to operate with impunity or even to operate at all, given the revelations of one of their own rabbis, Jacob Rothman. And as a result, we then saw what was really more of a civil war within Russia than a series of reasonless, unreasonable pogroms, wherein the Kahal and the Tsars went into open warfare, and it included the assassination of Alexander II, and then subsequently it was finally terminated with the Bolshevik Revolution, when the Tsar, then his entire family was mercilessly assassinated in Ekaterinburg, and then we had the diabolical Bolshevik Revolution and the regime known as communism. And everybody is familiar with what that was all about.
Is secular Judaism going to change more quickly, this supremacist ethic that has been a real problem for a long time? Jews have had trouble in many, many countries over a long period of time, and it's not good to see happen.
Well, it's a very sad thing, and it's a very difficult thing, because Judaism has unfortunately been defined by its priests, and its priests, unfortunately, appear to have been entirely subverted by the Babylonian and satanic practices that have ultimately been given expression in the Talmud. And any person with any sense of virtue, a modern sense of virtue, which is basically the golden rule, that you know, one does unto others what one would expect or would like to have done unto themselves. These doctrines in the Shulchan Aruch and in other parts of the Talmud are so obviously amoral that it doesn't require very much to distance oneself from them. But however, for some reason, the Jewish people have not, as a whole, taken it upon themselves as a very important spiritual and civic responsibility to denounce these doctrines and to state categorically that this was an errant strand of Judaism. I would maintain that it is very important for people in general to continuously update their scriptures and not to get stuck with the positions of some very powerful ruler or priest from thousands of years ago who may, in fact, and it's quite clear in many cases, did have ulterior motives, namely their own particular power or the subjugation and control of a particular property. But as for when the Jewish community is going to take the bit in their teeth, geez, I don't know. You know, I'm hoping that I'm part of the solution there. And the real reason why I bring all this up right now is because we can see the operation of the supremacist cabal within Judaism right now, with people like Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and David Wormser, all these guys.
Oh, they're so arrogant. It's
who wrote the Project for a New American Centuries documents that, you know, talked about the unipolar moment. They're setting up America to be the vehicle through which they impose a one-world militaristic hegemony.
I've not ever seen or witnessed such arrogance on the part of any group of people before. And their Alfred E. Newman puppet is the perfect front man to keep people distracted. The guy is just he's a study and a half.
I don't actually know to what you're referring to, but
Bush.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's funny. The recent book by Pretext for War by James Bamford, the very, very famous author of the books on the National Security Agency, who brought us the confirmation of the Northwoods documents, wherein Joint Chiefs of Staff signed off on plans to attack Americans in order to legitimate a war with a foreign nation.
If you folks don't know what we're talking about, please Google Operation Northwoods. Check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we know that the militaries are willing to attack their own nations in order to create pretext for war. What Bamford does is he describes a National Security Council meeting which was attended by Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, and Paul O'Neill revealed this in his own book. I can't remember what it's called. But what happened was that apparently Bush came to the table and said, look, we're just going to forget about the Palestinian issue, basically. I'm going to leave it to Ariel Sharon's hands. I know that he's been called a war criminal and all the rest of it, but, you know, he seems like he's doing a rather good job. And apparently Colin Powell and some of the other guys around the table were just, like, totally awestruck. And then shortly afterwards, it comes out that he had just been flown on a trip to Israel by the Republican Jewish coalition,
mm-hmm.
whose directors include Ari Fleischer and Michael Eisenberg, Louis Michael Eisenberg, who had been the chairman of the Republican National Fundraising Committee.
Yep.
So this was all very, very disconcerting to me. And so, you know, I'm concerned that, first of all, I'm concerned for the future of our planet. And regardless of what happens in this war with Iraq a war with Iran and Iraq would potentially bring in Russia and China.
Right.
You know, we could have another world war.
Easily.
And a world war at this stage of the game would make World War II look like a firecracker campaign.
Could be.
You know,
could,
so that's why I'm concerned.
Be.
And I feel like we must attack the supremacists in all nations. And the people of Jewish faith must attack their own supremacists in order to delegitimize their ideology such that we can just simply remove them from power.
All right. Leland, thanks very much for sharing your views tonight. We appreciate hearing them. And keep in touch. Keep writing.
I absolutely will, Jeff. It's been a pleasure and an honor to be on your show.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Bye now.
Good night. Leland Larima. And a lot of articles at Rents.com. And be hearing more from him, I'm sure, in the months and years ahead. And we'll pause and come right back.